Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
We go around now and say our names. My name is Jay Corbett.
It's John.
My name is Tom.
Daniel.
Peter.
George.
Todd Landrino.
Max.
G.
Adam.
Gary.
I'm Kay. Michael.
I'm Carl.
Andre.
You name.
David.
My name is Alzac.
I'm Jack.
I'm Marty.
I'm Bill.
My name is Ray Dyer.
Adrian.
My name is Clint.
Jim.
David.
Scott,
Robert,
Tripp,
Ryan,
Richard,
Peter,
Jim,
I'm Jerry,
Doy,
Robert,
Jim,
Becker,
Rich,
Tage,
I'm Don,
Joel,
I'm Dan,
hello,
my name is Reggie,
David,
Jim,
my name is Tony.
Anyone else? Anyone here for the first or second time? Okay, welcome. Please try to be friendly to these people. In our social hour. Our speaker today is Tim Wickens, which, despite his name, practices Buddhism. he has been practicing in the Theravada tradition since 1991 and studied with many Western lay teachers and with senior monks in the Burmese and Thai traditions. He lived and worked for 2 years at Spirit Rock Meditation Center and has attended retreats around the U.S. and in Canada, England, and Burma, where he spent a retreat as an ordained monk. Tim lives in Santa Rosa with his partner Robert and works as a carpenter and co-facilitates an LGBTQ sitting group there. He will give us a talk on the crucible of self-doubt. Please welcome Tim.
Thank you, Jay. It's nice to be here again, and I see a lot of friends here as well. It's really nice to see so many people who've been old friends. I do want to mainly speak about working with self-doubt because it's something I've learned a lot about and would, you know, hope to be helpful to others with. But I also know that given the recent election, there probably is still some energy within a lot of us around some of the results. So I also pulled together a few ideas that I'll start with about that. The core teaching of the Buddha about liberation, as we probably all know, is about attachment or clinging, and the letting go of that attachment to whatever. So the Buddha taught about four kinds of attachment. Attachment to a sense of self, separate self. Attachment to views and opinions. Attachment to rites and rituals, and the fourth, sense pleasures. So, views and opinions. You know, we probably all have some views and opinions about how the election went. So the Buddha's, and there probably is a lot of, you know, if you think about all over the world even, all over the country, all over San Francisco, all over California, there's probably some suffering going on right now because of the results of the election, of various propositions and offices and all. We all probably became attached to wanting a certain person or a certain result. The having a view or an opinion is not in and of itself a problem, the Buddha said. It's the attachment to it that is where the suffering comes in. So the question then becomes, well, I suppose the first question is, you know, am I interested in suffering less? And if so, how to let go of that attachment? It might be tempting to try to let go if you sort of sign up and say, okay, the Buddha said the way out of this is to let go. It's easy to think of letting go of anything as being, like how to do that, as being ignoring it, just trying to drop it out of an, you know, decision or an act of will, even push it away, to ignore it or just drop it. Well, there's subtleties here, but it's easy for that to be a strengthening delusion, not really being with it. And to try to push something away, that's aversion. That's strengthening, that's just creating more suffering. So so I would suggest that that to allow ourselves to be feeling what we're feeling, to be reacting as we're reacting, but to try to hold that reaction and those feelings with mindfulness, with awareness, to allow them, but to not be overwhelmed by them. If we do push them away, they'll probably just keep coming back. They haven't been released. So, you know, it's usually letting go is often a unpleasant endeavor. You know, it requires allowing unpleasant feelings, but or pleasant feelings, because we get attached to, of course, pleasant senses. Sensations, etc. So, let's see. The Thai forest teacher Ajahn Chah, he famously said, "If you let go a little, you'll have a little freedom. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of freedom or peace. And if you let go completely, you'll have complete peace." Not easy to do, but at least a suggestion about a path to pursue. So on to self-doubt and confidence, because ultimately it's. I've come to see my struggle, and we probably, many of us, have, you know, been going through the same struggle for a long time. My struggle with self-doubt. I've come to see it as a crucible. Any knot, any karmic knot, anything that is a real difficulty in our life that is there over and over and over again, year after year, keeps coming back no matter how much therapy or whatever that we do. If we keep engaging it with wisdom, with some guidance that actually is effective, it's what could be better than something like that for our growth? We can only learn through it. So self-doubt has been my big knot. I've been, and it really comes up, it's come up very strongly for me in my work life and in my practice, especially in my practice. And I've attended a lot of long, silent, intensive retreats where, you know, I'm pretty much just left with it. And it's been very painful, and I've had a very helpful teacher, Michelle McDonald. I've been struggling with this with her help for about 15 years, and have a shift has happened. 2.5 years ago, when I was here speaking about self-doubt, it was underway. But in fact, I was invited to return the next year to give an update. I didn't have an update after another year. So this year I do, thankfully. So what I mean by self-doubt, just to my experience of it, I you know, I could define it by what the dictionary says, but my experience is a pattern, a sort of a syndrome, if that's the right word, a combination of thoughts and feelings. Thoughts like, for example, trying to meditate, trying to do this practice. This is hopeless. I'm never going to get anywhere with this. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had that thought. And then feelings follow on, usually. Despair, hopelessness. Panic, terror, anger, you know, all of it. So for me, self-doubt has been not only a doubt in my ability to do something, to succeed at what I'm trying to do, but it's also been doubt about my worthiness, really. You know, I've taken it very personally. Classically, doubt, and for good reason, was mentioned, was listed by the Buddha as being one of what he called the five hindrances, a list you're probably familiar with: aversion, desire, restlessness, sleepiness, basically, and doubt. Classically, doubt is defined as being, described as being doubt in the Buddha, doubt in his teachings, the Dharma, doubt in the community, the Sangha, or doubt in one's teacher. It certainly includes self-doubt, but it's usually not talked about that way. So one of the traditional antidotes prescribed in the teachings for doubt is to reflect on the teachings, to listen to a talk by a wonderful teacher, to look for inspiration. For me, I've been blessed with, I've never doubted the Buddha or the Dharma or the Sangha. Plenty of people who follow his teachings, I'm sure, do. It's natural. It hasn't been my issue. There's always been faith. So that particular prescribed antidote hasn't really applied to me at all. I ran across a quote. Where is this? by an 11th century Chinese Zen master, Chan master. When you are deluded and full of doubt, even 1,000 books of scripture are not enough. So sometimes even that antidote doesn't work, all the scriptures. Oftentimes for me, being in retreats and listening to Dharma talks in the evening, which is meant to be inspiration and also a little bit of a break from the intensity of nonstop, mindfulness practice day in and day out, I would end up comparing myself to whatever the teacher seemed to be or was talking about. And I would come out of talks just in utter black despair, you know, trying to do walking meditation afterwards at night in the dark. It was terrible. My teacher, Michelle, actually suggested to me that I stop going to Dharma talks. The one thing, besides lunch, that you get in retreats. I did keep going because I really needed them. But so again, as my friend Eric Kolvig has pointed out, doubt and fear tend to reinforce each other. You know, the doubt brings up fear, and then the fear sets up a mind state where it's easy to get into a cyclical pattern of thought. You know, I can't do this, or whatever. Properly, doubt refers only to a thought. It's just a thought. But it's when that thought is identified with, believed in, amplified, and when it triggers a whole set of emotions that also are believed in and amplified, that it that's why I call it a syndrome. It's a whole knot that happens. I've been thinking about the stock market volatility that's been going on. That's nothing other than doubt, a lack of confidence, and fear, you know, on a social scale. And that brings up another point. It's not that sometimes doubt has a useful message. Sometimes there's a good reason to be doubting something. You know, it's not the positive side of doubt is that we don't just accept things blindly. You know, we're asked. It's good to be a little skeptical, to question, and that is a form of doubt. That's a useful use of doubt. You can call it inquiry, but a questioning. In fact, the Buddha basically asks us to doubt three things, what are referred to as the three characteristics of all experience. He asks us to doubt our assumption that there is a separate, solid sense, self here, separate from everyone else. He asks us to question that and to investigate that. He asks us to question our assumption, if we have made it at any level in our minds, that that we can organize our world, our experience, our environment in such a way that we won't suffer. You know, we're basically always trying to manipulate things to make it better. And so that second characteristic of all experience is that basically that attempt is futile. That some degree of dissatisfaction or suffering is inherent in being in a human body and living in the world. That's just a fact of life. But we tend to not live with that understanding. And the third characteristic that of all existence that he talked about, of all experience, is that all things change, impermanence. And so he asks us to question our assumption that, you know, we won't get sick, that our that all that we love and people we care about won't get sick, won't die, that we won't die. He asks us to question that assumption. So there is a positive side to doubt. He didn't, however, ask us to doubt our goodness, to doubt our capacity to enact his teachings and to become free. You know, with that he gives us his full confidence, his full support. The most difficult, doubt is considered to be the most sort of pernicious, the most difficult of the five hindrances to practice, because as I'm sure you can understand, when the mind is full of doubt, it completely undermines our motivation. If I don't think I can do it, it's really hard to even try. Or if you don't think, if you, you know, are doubting the Buddha's teachings, why would you make a huge effort to try? So, it's a hard one. It's a really hard one. What helped me, now remember that that doubt itself is a thought. What helped me, ultimately, was the heart, a heart quality to bring in to this thought dilemma. Loving kindness practice, metta practice. It helped during a retreat, a 3-week retreat up in British Columbia earlier this year. I was up there because that's where my teacher, Michelle, was teaching. And I, again, during this retreat, as so many times, I felt I couldn't go on. I was just so racked with suffering. You know, here I am on an island off of northern Vancouver Island in the middle of nowhere in this howling wind and rain for 3 weeks, and I could not practice. I was absolutely convinced that it was useless. I couldn't do it. It was like trying to touch a hot coal or something, you know, just to even think about trying to be mindful for one more moment was just too painful. I couldn't do it. I was sort of, you know, it was really a kind of a crisis for me, and I couldn't leave, you know, I was stuck on this island. You know, I didn't have an interview with her scheduled anytime soon. So I realized, okay, there's this question and answer period in the morning. And at the end, I might be able to get a question, and even though there's, you know, 80 other people here or something. And maybe that will magically solve everything, and it actually did. But during that sitting, before the question and answer period, I was obsessively thinking, how can I formulate my question in such a way? How can I arrange my experience in such a way that I can free myself from suffering? And so I was just going over and over and over it. And fortunately, I happened to mention, when I did try to express all this that was going on, that I'd been obsessively thinking. And that was the key. She said, this was in a loving kindness retreat. So that was the instruction to be doing, saying phrases, may I be safe and protected, may I be healthy and strong, may I be happy and peaceful, may I live with abundance and ease, saying that over and over and over again for 3 weeks without stop. She said, I would send metta to the thinking. It's like taking the enemy and wishing it well. The other thing that was helpful right then was her... Michelle frames the hindrances those things that foul up and clog up our practice is one way of looking at it. She reframes those habits of our mind not as problems, not as enemies, but as ways that we're trying to protect ourselves from pain. You know, we are pushing away experience because we don't want to be hurt, you know, because we want to be happy. Or we're trying to keep that thing that is so pleasant, ice cream, whatever, a wonderful calm mind during sitting, because we want to be happy. And so she applied that to the thinking mind in general, and I applied it to the thinking that was going on for me, realizing all this thinking that's happening, all this suffering, is because I'm trying to be happy. I'm just doing it in a way that is utterly not working. But that is the motivation. And when I connected with that goodness in myself, a forgiveness happened. And acceptance of what was happening happened. Calm happened. I mean, it just everything opened up. It was connecting with the goodness. Almost brings tears to my eyes just remembering it. There's even a quote by a fairly fierce Burmese teacher that came to mind. He said, "The proximate cause of doubt is an improper adjustment of the mind in the search for truth." It's an improper adjustment of the mind, yes, but the motivation is we're searching for truth, we're searching for happiness. So And to try to tie it in a little bit again to the election, I know this isn't the case for everyone. I know this isn't the case for everyone, but for me, and I haven't talked myself into this, it's just the way I see things. For me, I can't find anyone or any proposition or any supporter of any proposition, any candidate, who I don't believe is trying to be happy for themselves, and who I can't actually wish well in that pursuit. It doesn't mean that I condone their methods of trying to be happy, and it certainly doesn't mean that I am blind to they're causing harm in others. I do believe in the fundamental goodness in people and their motivation to be happy. It's just in the means that it gets that harm happens sometimes. So I had tried using metta practice for years. So I guess there was maybe some kind of ripening that happened. I had tried using metta practice by the instructions, saying these phrases over and over and over and over and over, you know, thousands and thousands of times. But a line in a New Yorker article that I read recently helped me understand a little bit better what was going on. It was an article in August about the rising up of the monastics in Burma, the protests there. The monks were protesting, marching down the streets, and they were chanting the Metta Sutta, the Loving Kindness Sutta. They were basically saying those words over and over and over again. And the guy in this article, who's a Burmese man who was being interviewed, said that he felt that the protest had ultimately failed because, he said, the monks had chanted the Metta Sutta without genuine loving kindness. There was still anger in their hearts. So, you know, how many times have I said the phrases of loving kindness practice, and actually what was happening was, you know, anger or despair or whatever? I mean, you do the best you can. But in genuine loving kindness didn't help. I wish for everyone a capacity to wish themselves genuinely well. It feels good when it has happened for me. Just one more thing that, well, more than that, but one more thing about how Michelle helped. When I told her that I was basically starting to get her teaching, her understanding about reframing the hindrances as protections, she said, people don't get that it's all coming out of love. Like everything we do, it at some level is coming out of love. So when this all broke open, the fear calmed down, the emotions calmed down. There was equanimity of this balance of mind, and the doubting thoughts kept happening, and fear, moments of fear kept happening. But there was enough calm, enough steadiness to be able to actually do what the Buddha recommended, which is be mindful. Another classical antidote for doubt is to directly observe your experience and to observe it with enough continuity, a sustained attention, vichara, that there pretty much isn't room left for doubt. But I realize you can't just start there usually. It takes some work to get to that place. And then, you know, then I could notice a doubting thought and not believe it. And it was let go of. Or fear came up. Oh, what if I get stuck in this again? You know, what if, you know, has anything really changed? And I could notice that thought, feel the fear, allow them to last as long as they lasted, and let them go. And I was protected. Michelle talks about this practice being one of replacing greed, hatred, and delusion with wisdom and loving kindness, which are better protections than greed, hatred, and delusion. Those words don't sound very good. You wouldn't think that you would take that up as a protection, but pretty much that's what you know, we do from a very young age. In fact, later in the retreat, an experience happened where there was another shift just happened of its own, where the thinking mind actually felt foreign. As much as anyone, I've tried to think my way out of my problems. And it certainly hasn't helped with self-doubt. But this experience, all I wanted to do was to reside in just being, just feeling, just a non-conceptual awareness. And then there really wasn't any challenge from doubt. It's just a thought. And this is why the Buddha, I believe it's why he taught, he didn't teach meditation to people right off the bat. He first taught the practice of generosity and ethical conduct, and then concentration. All of those, if you're running around causing a lot of harm, your mind is probably caught up in regret and maybe fear. It's not calm. And as our thoughts and actions become less harming, more purified, the mind can calm down. And with concentration practice, the mind can calm down. And then we can catch this stuff instead of being crazy and trying to catch it. It's written, it's not easy. So we've probably often all heard that a balanced heart mind is composed of wisdom and compassion. You know, there's the, well, I don't even want to call it mental, but wisdom and compassion. So I've found that both are not only helpful, but essential for working with self-doubt, and if it's a big issue. certainly, my teacher's love for me and her compassion for me helped. And when I could get to the place of forgiving myself, it all opened up. And my faith, you know, a heart quality, my faith in the teachings. I mean, why didn't I give up? It was only because of faith. So that certainly was part of the story for me. The wisdom side of this, the wisdom perspective on working with this, is, as I've said, that doubt is only a thought. And it's usually a thought about the future. It's a future thought. Another quote by Sayadaw Upandita, Burmese teacher, he defined doubt as the exhaustion of the mind through conjecture. And conjecture is about the future. It's not about what's happening right now. And it is exhausting. I mean, if the mind is exhausted, it's not conducive to, you know, clear seeing, to clear thinking, to decision making. It's exhausted. So I've been exhausted in retreat a lot. I also know that, you know, this is my story. I know that for different people and for any given person at different times, different strategies are going to be what are effective. It's sort of going in the moment with what feels right. I read somewhere, I have no idea, and I even probably have the names wrong, but the basic idea really struck me. Apparently a couple of the Buddha's most senior disciples, it was about the two of them, and one of them, might have been Moggallana, he attained liberation by cutting attachment, a very wisdom approach, like Manjushri and the sword, you know, cutting through attachment. And another of his senior disciples, might have been Sariputta, nurtured non-attachment. So those are two different, like, attitudes, approaches to working with ourselves. And one could be right in one moment, one could be the other one right in another moment. You know, it's how much do we come at this in any given moment as with a warrior energy? Like, no. You know, not with aversion, but with a sort of a fierce clarity. And how much at other times do we come to it through more heart qualities? Allowing, trying to be understanding. I mentioned when I was here a couple of years ago, I had just been at a monastery in England with Ajahn Sumedho from the Thai forest tradition, a senior Western monk. And I went to him about doubt, about self-doubt. I've looked everywhere. and his, after yes-butting him for about 20 minutes, he finally sort of pulled himself up and looked me straight in the eyes, and he's this big, sort of imposing guy. He said, "Order yourself to trust yourself." And that's like, yes, trust is a heart quality, but the ordering part of it, you know, is more the wisdom or the cutting kind of energy, I couldn't do it. It wasn't where I was at. It was sage advice, and it probably worked for him. But I needed more love in the mix to loosen the attachment to a view I had about myself, you know, my capacities. I ran across another quote here that expresses a nice balance of the two, the heart and the mind, the wisdom and the compassion, from Pema Chodron, from her book Wisdom of No Escape. She wrote, "The desire to change yourself, the desire to change is fundamentally a form of aggression toward yourself. The point of meditation is to befriend who we already are, to see it clearly with precision, honesty, and gentleness." Another way of looking at this whole process is to see it as a purification process, and the Buddha described his teachings, the whole path, as a process of purification. So we can see the hindrances, including doubt, as shadow or as toxins. In fact, another little political interjection here. Larry Yang, you probably know Larry Yang's name, teaches here in the city and in the East Bay. He was talking with a friend, and they were talking about the possibility of Obama becoming president and what that would mean about the healing that's already happened in this country, you know, if for him to be elected. And Larry pointed out, in fact, predicted even, yes, a certain amount of healing must already have happened, surely. But if it does come to be, it's going to flush out all the toxins, or more of them, or another round of them, you know. So we might be in for some more, but it's a purification process to hold it with that understanding. Sometimes suffering is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering, or towards the end of suffering, at least. Seeing it as a purification process, especially with the deep, whatever deep knots we might have in our hearts and minds, karmic knots, as Michelle calls them, things that we deal with over, they keep coming back, over year after year after year, still dealing with it. Might go away and then it comes back again. We might want to shortcut that process because we want to be happy. It's understandable that we might want to shortcut that process. But even if we could, we'd be missing out on the real benefit of going through the process. I look at all the side effects, the positive, liberating side effects in my mind that have happened because of dealing with this very painful thing. The patience I've developed, 15 years, retreat after retreat, every single retreat is a dukkha retreat, you know? The patience, the perseverance, the equanimity that's come out of it. That's actually my understanding of the intention of the Buddha's teachings. You know, he gives us a simple and impossible thing to do: maintain attention on something, your breath or whatever. Very simple, totally impossible. if we could really completely stay with our breath or anything else, would we be instantly liberated? No. It's the side effects. It's all the stuff that happens on the side as we're looking straight ahead trying to do this thing. All this other stuff is happening. These qualities of the heart are being developed and ripened on the side. That's actually the goal. Because it's when the seven factors of awakening, these factors like equanimity, become mature and come into balance, that this magical mystery of awakening, those are the conditions under which it can happen. So let's see, just a couple more quotes I ran across that seemed relevant. The completion of this quote from the 11th century Chinese Zen master, Fen Yang, the rest of it, the whole thing, when you are deluded and full of doubt, even 1,000 books of scripture are not enough. When you have realized understanding, even one word is too much. And Sensaki Roshi, 20th century Rinzai master, when one devotes oneself to meditation, mental burdens, unnecessary worries, and wandering thoughts drop off one by one. Life seems to run smoothly and pleasantly. A student may now depend on intuition to make decisions. As one acts on intuition, second thought, with its dualism, doubt, and hesitation, does not arise. Doesn't that sound nice? But it is possible. Guarantee you. That's all I have to say. Does anyone have any questions or comments?
I have a dozen bolts of question. When you're directing loving kindness to your thoughts, that seems like kind of a rather abstract thing to direct loving kindness to. Did you personify your thoughts in some way? I mean, how did you actually do that?
Trying to remember back. To practice at all requires a certain stepping back of one layer, a witness mind, a generation of that which can see. So, yes, I was... it probably was a combination of things. There were probably moments. I mean, it was all during the course of one sitting where it all unfolded. And I was probably sometimes sending thoughts to the idea of my thinking mind that's getting me in all this trouble. To an image of myself suffering. I don't know if it was actually a visual image, but I'd spent so much time with me suffering that it was pretty easy to conjure up. I was in it, though. At the beginning of that sitting, I was still completely in it. The key was that, well, for whatever reasons, enough practice or whatever, enough love from other people, confidence from other people in me, that I was able to genuinely wish myself well. That was really the key. Just the idea of sending metta, as we say, of wishing well my thoughts. It helped me disidentify from them right then. It's like, oh, this is all... It helped me connect with the pain. you know, if there's anything or anyone in your life, a pet, a plant, it was a lake for someone, you know, about, if anything, whatever you can actually genuinely wish well without a backlash of reaction. Strengthen that, you know, start there and strengthen that. And, you know, when the time is right, it'll happen. I don't know. I just was able to do it. I'm not sure exactly what I did. It was just sort of a hole.
Maybe you got one more question?
Oh, dear.
Not really a question. I just wanted to say that I was here a couple of years ago when you gave your initial talk after your retreat in England about self-doubt. And I just want to say it's really wonderful and inspirational to hear you speak today, Tim, because it really opens up the possibility for me, and I think for everyone, to, with patience and persistence and faith and all the things you talked about, to shift and open and let go. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it is. It is.
Sure, Jeff.
And Tim, thank you again for speaking from such a personal place. And I feel another good the way you're talking. Given the sort of distance you've garnered from the grip of this, what do you think was there any payoff to enduring it for so long? I mean, was there any reward from within that? I mean, frequently when people are stuck, there's something they get out of it. I mean, do you have any sense of that? That was an element that protected you in some way or...
Protected me? Oh. That I was getting out of not letting go of it?
Yeah.
I see. Sure, I was trying to protect myself. From what? Yeah, okay, let me see if I can... You know, again, I feel that probably the critical transition was... And there wasn't even in a moment for this. I'm not sure when it happened or why it happened, how it happened, anything. It was when I was able to genuinely wish myself well. And so I think before that, I was protecting myself from, you know, harming myself, from feeling, from the feeling of feeling so bad about myself, from feeling unworthy of love, you know, unworthy of success, you know, self-esteem. Basically, it's, you know, it does feel oftentimes that there are different kind of layers of our psyche or parts of ourselves, and part of me was and is still, you know, absolutely determined to get free. And the way in which I was doing that, I actually was really harming myself a lot. I had to stop practice entirely for about 6 months because I realized just how much harm I was inflicting upon myself in trying to do meditation practice. I had to stop. I was hurting myself. So there was a war going on inside, and probably a lot of different factors ameliorated that over time. And it got to the point where I could very tenderly, gently experiment with not reacting to wishing myself well. Could I actually accept that? You know, very tender, very vulnerable place.
Tim, will you hang out for a while afterwards for anyone else who might have questions for you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sure.
Okay, now we do announcements. Are there any announcements? Jerry.
Yes, I'm Jerry, your speaker coordinator, and thanks, Tim, for coming today.
Oh, you're welcome, Jerry.
And next week, I think everybody knows this, but this is the San Francisco Buddhist Center, and it's part of the Western Buddhist Order, and the director of it is going to speak next week. Actually, she lives upstairs. Her name is Suvanna Collins, so she'll be here.
Yeah, I'm the host today, so I'll just go through the kind of rules. There's the tea, and please help yourself. Make sure you clean your cup with soapy hot water when you're done. There's a few things to eat out there. I realize Tim was here, I brought you more. But
oh, thank you.
There's a donable, and the suggested donation is $5 to $8 if one cares to give, to donate. Many of us meet after, I think, around 12:30 by the front door if anyone cares to join some others for lunch. And there's a thickish sign-up sheet that's on the credenza, should be at least, so if people want to get on the mailing list, you can sign up there. I think that's about it.
Any other announcements? Okay.
It's our tradition to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. At GBF, we have annual Thanksgiving potluck, and again, it will be held at my place on Thanksgiving Day in East Bay. And those of you who are interested in coming, please let me know ahead of the time. You're certainly welcome to bring a friend, and if you decide to show up, that's okay. But we try to coordinate dishes a little bit for this particular potluck, so it will have the semblance of the traditional meals. There is a sign-up sheet on the credenza also, but if you want to call me or email me, that'd be fine too. So, again, thank you.
I just want to encourage people to not forget the donable.
Will you take it around, so? Our hosts?
Yeah, I can remember.
Thanks. Any announcements? Gary?
I'm hosting a game and singles mixer a week from today at Mecca at 7, so if anyone's interested in going to it or getting on the e-bike, they can talk to me. There's often a little Buddhist contingent.
And for anyone who's been to one of Gary's previous things, there will be no entertainment this
month. At Jay's request. No entertainment.
I actually have an announcement. A teacher friend of mine in Sonoma County, and I have finally, just after a couple of years of working on it, started an LGBTQQI sitting group in Santa Rosa, in the living room of the house that I live in with my partner Robert. Monday was the first evening, and one person showed up. So we actually were able to start. If you live in Santa Rosa, or if you know anybody up in that area, we'd love to have you. And flyers. I have flyers.
Another thing you might want to do, we have a Yahoo group that has lots of subscribers.
Okay.
So you could send an announcement to that, and some people on that might live up there.
Great. Thank you.
Yes.
Speaking of sitting groups, there is also a weekly sitting group every Monday afternoon at the LGBT Center from 5:30 to 6:30. It's a half-hour meditation and then a half-hour Dharma talk or discussion, and it's been going on for quite some time, a little more than 6 years, and so it's a good 1-2 punch Sunday and Monday for some of us who can't manage that daily practice every single day. So Monday's at 5:30 on third floor in the Gay Center.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, let's stand for our Tim.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Sure, I'll do something else. I can do something. Take a moment to feel your body, to feel your feet on the ground, to feel the probably warm hand of the man on either side of you, to feel the aliveness of your body, the breathing body. May we all learn to let go in a peaceful way of any attachments, including views and opinions, that may be bringing suffering to ourselves or those around us. And may we learn to genuinely wish ourselves and all those around us well. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.